Now, again, before I start, I'm not sure when I'm supposed to finish, but no doubt there will be splendid things available afterwards. Do you know what the time is for tonight, the timetable for tonight is? Can someone enlighten me? It's now 1:45, yes? When do I need to finish? 9:00. Well, that's generous indeed. Let's see how we go, and if we've got time for some questions afterwards, well, that would be good. So in the 2nd of Samuel and chapter 21, we're really going to look at just the first 14 verses, the first half, as it were, the first major section of the 2nd of Samuel chapter 21, and this is about the riddle of the vigil of Rizpah. And the record starts in verse 1 by saying, "Then there was a famine in the days of David 3 years, year after year." Now, just hold your hand for a moment, now that I've safely got you to chapter 21. Just hold your hand and come to chapter 24, just for a moment. Because I want to draw attention to just one key word in the 24th chapter. It says there, at the in the very first verse, actually, it says, "And again, the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Israel." Now, you see that phrase, "again, the anger of God was kindled." In the margin, it says, "Why, see chapter 21, verse 1. So coming back to chapter 21, verse 1, what the marginal reference would bid us understand is that the famine of chapter 21 was a manifestation of the anger of God. And so when chapter 24 says, "Then again the anger of God was kindled," that it's again after this episode that we're going to read tonight in the 21st chapter. And what we're being told is that perhaps this famine didn't come about by chance. In fact, if you come back to Deuteronomy chapter 11, this is what the record of the book of the law said concerning famines that might come. They came for a reason. They came because of the providential control of the Father. Because in Deuteronomy chapter 11 in the book of the law, we're told this in verse 13. Deuteronomy 11 verse 13. "And it shall come to pass, if ye shall hearken diligently unto my commandments which I command you this day, to love Yahweh your God, and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, that I will give you the rain of your land in his due season, the first rain and the latter rain, that thou mayest gather in thy corn and thy wine and thy oil." And if I might just digress for a moment there, you'll probably be aware that when it speaks about the former rain, the first rain and the latter rain, that there were two sort of like rain seasons, weren't there, in the calendar of Israel. The former rains came right at the end of summertime, and those former rains softened the soil that it might be ploughed for the season to come. And after the seed had been sown, the winter set in, and the cold came, even snow. And not until springtime, not until the time of the harvesting of the ripe barley in the month of Aviv, or Abib, which is of course the month of Passover, did the latter rains finally come to swell the growth of the grain of the season. So the latter rains came at springtime, and the former rains came, in fact, at the end of harvest, at the end of summertime. Well, that's what Deuteronomy says here in verse 14. And so the rain was an evidence of God's blessing. So if the rain was a symbol of God's blessing, verse 14 of Deuteronomy 11, then what would famine be a symbol of but the withholding of God's blessing? Which is exactly what it says. Verse 16, "Take heed to yourselves, that your heart be not deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them, and then Yahweh's wrath be kindled against you, and he shut up the heaven, that there be no rain, and that the land yield not her fruit." So you see, the rain was a symbol of God's approval, and the lack of rain was a symbol of God's disapproval and of his judgment on the nation. So the latter rain came at barley time, early harvest, the very start of the harvest season, and right at the other end of the harvest season came what strangely called the former rains, which were to soften the soil at autumn time for the sowing of the crops in the year to come. So coming back to 2 Samuel chapter 21, we assume therefore that when it says that there'd been a famine for 3 years, The reason why there was a famine is because, well, there was no rain. And that rain was indicative of the fact that God was in fact judging the nation at this time. And clearly David saw it as a matter serious enough to, well, it says, does it not, in verse 1, that he decided he better inquire of Yahweh. By the way, what would that mean? He inquired of Yahweh. How would he do that? What most probably does that indicate to us, do you think? It could be by prayer. Most likely by Urim and Thummim, he would have gone to the priest and asked counsel of the priest by means of Urim and Thummim. And the answer comes back, I think, from the priest. Yahweh answered by means of the priest, it is for Saul. It is for Saul and for his house of blood. And that, by the way, is the literal meaning of the Hebrew, his house of blood. And I think it's quite a good translation, not only because we would find that the other preferable not to say, but because in fact it gives us the clue, I think, to the whole story of this riddle. So in other words, it is for Saul and for his house or his family upon which rested the guilt of the shedding of whatever blood is going to be talked about in this chapter. So what David finds out is there's unfinished business. There's a matter here of national sin that God has held Israel accountable for. Why this famine? Why this lack of the rain of divine blessing and approval? It is, comes the answer of God, because of the house of Saul, his house of blood. God had a matter of judgment against his people. And so verse 2 says that the king called the Gibeonites. Because, of course, verse 1 had said it is for the house of Saul and for his house of blood because he slew the Gibeonites. So now we're told that the king called the Gibeonites and said unto them. And now you notice this little bit in parenthesis or brackets which says, now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites, and the children of Israel had sworn unto them. And Saul sought to slay them in his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah. Well, that really takes us back to Joshua chapter 9, because in Joshua chapter 9, we've got the story of how those Gibeonites came to be in the midst of the land. And I know that you will know the story of the Gibeonites in the days of Joshua, but I just want to draw attention to a couple of interesting things in that particular chapter. It is because of the Gibeonites came the answer to David, and the king called the Gibeonites and said unto them, these Gibeonites that were not of Israel, but unto whom the children of Israel had sworn. So Joshua chapter 9, verse 14 says, and the men of Joshua, the men of Israel, took of their victuals and asked not counsel at the mouth of Yahweh. That's an interesting thing, by the way, because David does ask counsel, doesn't he? In Joshua's day, they forgot to ask counsel. They asked not counsel at the mouth of the Lord. And Joshua made peace with them, and made a league with them to let them live. And the princes of the congregation swear unto them. In fact, this is what they swear, verse 18. It says, the children of Israel smote them not, because the princes of the congregation had sworn unto them by Yahweh Elohim of Israel. They had sworn an oath by the name of God that the Gibeonites would be preserved and safe amongst the children of Israel. In fact, the record says it gave them cities. And the names of the cities, verse 17, I just want you to tuck these away, because, you know, it's a funny thing with every story. Every story is composed of all the little details which, when woven together, suddenly give us the fullness of the story, you see. You mustn't miss any detail. And the detail here of the cities of the Gibeonites, which might just be pertinent, verse 17, their cities were Gibeon and Kephirah and Beeroth and Kirjath-Jearim. Mind you, of course, when Joshua did make the Gibeonites to be safe in the land and swore an oath before the God of Israel that they would be safe in covenant with Israel, he relegated them to a menial duty, didn't he? Because of their deception. What did Joshua make the Gibeonites to do? Why, verse 27 of this chapter, absolutely correct. It says he made them both hewers of wood and drawers of water. Ah, now that's interesting. because in the 2nd of Samuel chapter 21 there's no water in the land. Even the drawers of water can no longer bring forth water for the service of the congregation of Israel. Oh yes, I think that this blessing was somehow linked to the Gibeonites, you see. There's no water in the land. Now you see, Saul's actions, coming back to the 2nd of Samuel chapter 21, were a violation of that covenant that had been sworn in Joshua chapter 9. And it may have been, we're not told, it may have been that the Gibeonites had cried unto Yahweh for relief from the work of Saul and coming against them. We're not told whether they did, and we're not told not only whether they did, but when they might have cried unto God for retribution. We don't know what time elapsed from the moment they called God or called upon God to the time where God finally deals with the matter in the 2nd of Samuel chapter 21. But you know, I think, sisters, that strangely enough, the longer that time was, the more interesting it becomes. Because, you see, perhaps the lesson of the 2nd of Samuel chapter 21 and verse 2 is this: that God never forgets. God never forgets anything that's done. This might have been a sin that was committed against the Gibeonites some time ago. We're not told. But whether it was or whether it wasn't, the lesson of this chapter is that God will finally hold all accountable for all that they have done, and God never forgets, not anything. And he would remember this matter as well. Despite the despair of the Gibeonites, they were not forgotten, and neither was the sin that had been perpetrated against them. So David says in the 2nd of Samuel chapter 21 verse 3, "Wherefore David said to the Gibeonites, What shall I do for you? And wherewith shall I make the atonement that ye may bless the inheritance of Yahweh?" So David recognized that the matter of national sin here that needs atonement before God's judgment could be removed. And the strange thing about the story, as you stop and think about the fact that there might be a parable here, is that the solution in this story is going to result in Gentiles, the Gibeonites, in covenant blessing with Israel. So whatever sacrifice will be offered in this chapter, both Jew and Gentile will benefit ultimately from the sacrifice that will take place in the 2nd of Samuel chapter 21. Well, you see what the Gibeonites said, verse 4. "The Gibeonites said unto him, We will have no silver nor gold of Saul, nor of his house, neither for us shalt thou kill any man in Israel. We will have no silver or gold." You know, what the Gibeonites were saying is that financial compensation cannot atone for sin. We can't buy our way out of sin. Of course, they could have made a lot of money because, you know, in those days the nations did do that. They practiced financial reparation for untimely debts. The Gibeonites could have said, "Well, we'd like a large sum of cash, please, to put this matter right." The Gibeonites that have been slain. Or they could have made a fortune. But they didn't. You see, what the Gibeonites said was, "We will have no silver and no gold." And I think there was a reason. I think there was a scriptural reason why they said exactly that. No silver or gold, they said. And then they said this, perhaps not clear in the authorized version. They said, "Neither for us shalt thou kill any man in Israel." But what the Revised Standard Version says is, "Neither is it for us to put any man to death in Israel." Oh, shall I read that again? I'll just change the emphasis slightly, because remember how that the change of emphasis on the words alters the meaning. "Neither is it for us to put to death any man in Israel." Ah, now what do you think the Gibeonites were really saying? See, I think what they were saying was they believed that as a subject nation they had no authority to execute the sentence of judicial death themselves upon any inhabitant of Israel, but I think the implication is, when they said it doesn't pertain to us, what they really meant, what they obviously believed, was that there ought to be a death that should take place, but it was not their role, not their right, not their prerogative to execute the judgment on this occasion. They had no jurisdiction to act in the matter. Not for us to put any man to death. You think David understood what they were saying? Yes, I think so. Because you see what he said at the end of the verse? Verse 4. He said, "What ye shall say, that will I do for you." Now you see, David as a king could have ridden roughshod, couldn't he, over this minority group that were really only there in the nation because of the leniency of Joshua. But in effect, what David said to them, you know, was, "All right, I understand what you're saying. So you tell me then what we should do. Tell me what we need to do," he said to the Gibeonites. Now that was a wise spirit on David's part, because remember, there's a matter of national sin here and evidence of God's displeasure. And so the spirit of the king was that he recognized the direction of their request, not for us to put any man to death, and he made provision that their suggestion might in fact be acted upon. So he said to them, "So what shall I do then?" And they said, verse 5, they answered the king, "The man that consumed us and the devise against us that we should be destroyed from remaining in any of the coasts of Israel, the man that consumed us." You see, if there was to be any restitution, any compensation, then that restitution must come from the family that's committed the sin. And this sin comes from the family of Saul. And if the sin comes from the family of Saul, then from the house of Saul alone can the answer come in making amends. That's what the Gibeonites are saying, isn't it? "Can only come from the house of Saul," they said. "This is the house that has caused our blood, innocent blood, to be shed. From this man's house alone can the atonement come that's necessary on this occasion." So they said this, verse 6, "Let 7 men of his sons be delivered unto us, and we will hang them up." Now notice this. Notice carefully what they do say. "We will hang them up unto Yahweh." Not to themselves. This wasn't their own revenge. Did you notice that? Whatever they were going to do with these sons, they were going to hang them up before God. Now the interesting thing is, you know, that there weren't 7 of Saul's sons left alive. There were descendants of Saul, but of course in the Hebrew the term son can signify several generations of the same family, who were all deemed to be the son of a family line. So when it said, "Let 7 sons," well, first of all, I think that means, does it not, let there be a complete atoning sacrifice, 7. And the 7 sons are all going to be drawn from the house of Saul in expiation for the sin committed. Saul's family are to bear complete responsibility for the matter. 7 sons of Saul's house, let them be given unto us. "But we won't take them for our own revenge," said the Gibeonites. "We shall hang them up unto Yahweh." Now, by the way, I think what that means in verse 6 is it doesn't mean that they were impaled alive on stakes. What would have been done is that they would have been judicially executed first for the massacre of the Gibeonites, probably put to death by the sword, and then they would have been lifted up afterwards. For some reason, which we've yet to find out by and by as the story unfolds, the dead bodies of the 7 men thus slain were to be lifted up and placarded before Yahweh, was the request of the Gibeonites. Now, do you know, it's an interesting thing, but this request of the Gibeonites was exactly based on the teaching of the law of Moses. Exactly based on the teaching of the law of Moses. They might be strangers amidst Israel, but these Gibeonites are thoroughly biblical in their reasoning. Now, come and have a look at this. So hold your hand in Samuel and come back to the book of Numbers in chapter 35. Because Numbers 35 is what the book of the law said about the matter of murder in the nation. murder in Israel, how shall it be dealt with? And the law said thus in Numbers chapter 35. So reading from verse 16, the record said, Numbers 35, if he smite him with an instrument of iron so that he die, any man that does that against his brother, he's a murderer, and the murderer shall surely be put to death. And not only that, not only with iron, but also verse 17, if he smite him with the throwing of a stone wherewith he may die, and he die, he's a murderer, the murderer shall surely be put to death. Or verse 18, if he smite him with a hand weapon of wood wherewith he may die, and he die, he's a murderer, the murderer shall surely be put to death. So you see, the teaching of the law of Moses was that if someone had murdered somebody else, there was no escape from the consequences of that. The murderer had to be put to death, said the law of Moses. And Saul had murdered the Gibeonites, quite clearly murdered them. The requirement of the law was that the murderer must be put to death. But come over the page to verses 29 to 31 and just see what it says. Numbers 35 verse 29 says, so these things shall be for a statute of judgment unto you throughout your generations in all your dwellings. Whoso killeth any person, the murderer shall be put to death by the mouth of witnesses, but one witness shall not testify against any person to cause him to die. And now notice this, verse 31. And ye shall take no satisfaction for him that has fled to the city of his refuge, that he should come again to dwell on the land. He shall take no satisfaction. Do you know what that means in the book of the law? No silver or gold was to be paid as a satisfaction for the death. Only the life of the murderer itself was acceptable retribution where murder had occurred. Where do you think the Gibeonites got their idea from in the 2nd of Samuel chapter 21 when they said, we shall have no silver or gold? I think they got it straight out of the book of the law, you see. These drawers of water, they might be, but they were spiritually minded. And so once slain, the dead bodies were going to be crucified or lifted up before the face of God as a public exhibition of the punishment that had been inflicted and the satisfaction that was required for God's wrath to be turned away from amongst the children of Israel. You see, what we're being told, I think, is that this was not the spirit of mindless revenge. This was the spiritual response of the Gibeonites to the requirements of Almighty God in the very book of the law. And this, mind you, not to turn away judgment from the Gibeonites, was it? What the Gibeonites asked for was not to turn away judgment from themselves, but to turn away God's judgment that at that time rested upon the whole of the nation of Israel. Why, the salvation of the nation itself depended on what might be done on this occasion. Oh, and where were they going to hang up the seven dead bodies? 2 Samuel chapter 21, verse 6. We will hang them up unto Yahweh in Gibeah of Saul, it says, the home and the capital of Saul, who had brought the wrath of God upon the land through his crime. The very place where the murderer had lived is where the bodies shall be hung. And you see the tragedy of verse 6. It's Saul whom Yahweh did choose. And perhaps the lesson of that phrase, Saul whom Yahweh did choose, is that even the chosen of God are not exempt from upholding his commandments. In fact, they have a higher standard, don't they? The duty of example for those chosen is higher. They of all people are not above the commandments of God. And the reality was that whatever Saul's motive was, and we shall come to that by and by, because I think that his motive was probably altogether bad, it wasn't actually for the good cause of the truth at all. Whatever his motive was, that the teaching of the law was absolutely clear. We're told in another place, which we won't turn up, but you might like to take a note of. Exodus 21 verse 12 says, he that smiteth a man so that he die shall be surely put to death. Exodus 21 verse 12. The law was clear. That's what he'd done. He'd smitten other men to put them to death. The requirement of the law was the murderer must now forfeit his own life. And of course you realise that there was a reason behind that even, because this law of life for life and blood for blood, doesn't it go all the way back to Genesis chapter 9 when they first came out of the ark? And God said, if any man takes another man's life, I'll require that of that man's hand. Do you know why it says that in Genesis? I think, sisters, that if any man, and I suppose for that matter any woman, takes the life of another person, that their own life shall be forfeit before God, is because every person's life is a potential life to manifest Yahweh. And anyone else that takes that life doesn't just rob that person of life. They rob God of someone who could have manifested his name. God says, I will require that of you at your own hand when you take a life that belongs to me. So the Gibeonites said, and I think exactly in accordance with the spirit of the law, you better give us 7 sons of the house of Saul. And the record says, coming back to the 2 Samuel chapter 21, right at the end of verse 6, and the king said, I will give them. And I think David's answer showed his understanding of the spirit of the Gibeonites. You see, we could read, couldn't we? We could imagine just for a moment that perhaps David thought, what a marvellous opportunity to get rid of every rival part of Saul's house, to exterminate the lot of them. That could have been David's spirit, couldn't it? But no, I don't think so. In fact, by the time we come to the end of the story, we'll be absolutely convinced that that wasn't David's spirit at all. This was the wise decision of a king, acting on the information given to him after inquiring of Yahweh in verse 1. And by the way, it was consistent with the action of Moses. We won't turn it up, but you remember in Numbers 25 and verses 3 and 4, in the matter of the sin at Moab, that Moses was instructed by Yahweh himself to take the leaders of the apostasy and to slay them and to hang them up before Yahweh, Numbers 25. And if David had done this thing, he was only doing what Moses had already done on an earlier occasion. And most of all, I think what he did was based on the very passage used by the Gibeonites. Now come back and have a look at that passage. Which one was it? What was the teaching of the book of the law on the matter of murder? It was Numbers 35. So just come and have a look at that again, because I think that what David decided to do when he decided that he would agree with the Gibeonites' request is, I think he understood exactly where they were quoting from. He knew that they were quoting from the book of the law. And David's understanding was good enough that he recognized that he ought to acquiesce in their request. So reading Numbers 35 again, from verse 31, the record says this. Moreover, ye shall take no satisfaction for the life of a murderer which is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. And he shall take no satisfaction for him that has fled to the city of his refuge, that he should come again to dwell in the land until the death of the priest. So shall ye not pollute the land wherein ye are, for blood it defileth the land, and the land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed therein, but by the blood of him that shed it. The land cannot be cleansed but by the blood of him that shed innocent blood upon the land in the first place. And David understood that the blood guilt resting upon the land right now could only be cleansed by the blood of the criminal. And clearly God himself had stated, had he not, that this sin had not yet been atoned for, even though Saul himself was already dead, because there's a famine upon the land right now, as evidence of the fact that this is unfinished business in the eyes of Almighty God, who has not forgotten what's been done. The only way the land could be cleansed of innocent blood shed, said the book of the law, is by the shedding of the blood of those who offended in the first place. So when David said, I will give these men, I think he was acting exactly in accordance with the teaching of the law of Moses, you see. There's no spirit of revenge or malice here on David's part. So come back to the 2 Samuel chapter 21. You see what it says. Interesting, you know, verse 7, because we could perhaps misread this verse as well. Because verse 7 says of 2 Samuel 21, but the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of Yahweh's oath that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. he spared Mephibosheth because of David's oath. Now you see, if we read that carelessly, we might imagine that even though it says that, the reason why he spared Mephibosheth was because, well, Jonathan was his friend. Well, I don't want to kill his son. He's a friend of mine. So in other words, he showed favoritism to Jonathan, his dear friend, by sparing Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan. Well, it could be that, couldn't it? But no, it wasn't. Come and have a look at the oath that was made. In the 1st of Samuel, chapter 20, we've got one of three occasions where the oath between David and Jonathan is recorded. Just have a look at this one, and here's an illustration of why David does what he does in the 2nd of Samuel 21, when the record says that he deliberately, knowingly, specifically decides to spare Mephibosheth the son of Jonathan from this fate that shall befall seven of the sons of the house of Saul. In the 1st of Samuel chapter 20, it says this in verse 14. This is the oath that Jonathan, the dear friend of David, asked of his friend. He said, "And thou shalt not only while yet I live show me the kindness of Yahweh that I die not, but also thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. No, not when Yahweh hath cut off the enemies of David, every one from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "Let Yahweh even require it at the hand of David's enemies." And Jonathan caused David to swear again, because he loved him. For he loved him as he loved his own soul. And so he begged of David, "Thou shalt show kindness unto my house. Never forget that, David," he says. "Even after I'm dead, show kindness to my house. Don't ever cut them off." So now come back to the 2nd of Samuel chapter 21 and just think, sisters, for a moment about the dilemma that David has on this occasion. "Let seven men of the sons of Saul be given unto us." And the king knew that this was right. This was in accordance with the law. "But which sons, which boys, which men of the house of Saul shall he give?" And he said, I think I'll spare Mephibosheth. And this is why. Why has this whole catastrophe come upon the nation at this moment of time? Because Saul had broken a covenant oath that he had made. How can David, in solving that problem, now in turn break a covenant oath which he has made to Jonathan? He cannot do that, can he? So David keeps and honours his oath to Jonathan by sparing Mephibosheth. How in the circumstances of this crisis could he do anything else other than honour the oath that he'd made, when the reason for this disaster was that Saul forgot to honour his? So I think his motive was noble and pure when David decided on this occasion that he would spare Mephibosheth. And so 2 Samuel chapter 21 verse 8 says, "So who he took instead was this." Oh, now this is really interesting. Who exactly did he take and why? 2 Samuel chapter 21 verse 8 says, "But the king took the two sons of Rizpah the daughter of Ai, whom she bare unto Saul, Armoni and Mephibosheth." So this is another Mephibosheth. This is not Mephibosheth the son of Jonathan. This is another Mephibosheth who's actually a son of Saul. "And the five sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Maholathite." And at first sight, you almost imagine that what verse 8 is telling us is the king said, "All right, seven. Oh, well, we'll have that one, there's another one, there's another person, there's another boy, he's here at the house of Saul, we'll have him too." And he went out and he sort of picked seven that he could find of the house of Saul and cobbled them all together and said to the Gibeonites, "Here you are, take these then." Oh, no, I don't think David did that for a moment. I think that every one of these boys were so carefully chosen by the king on this occasion, despite the fact that this would bring tragedy into Rizpah's house. Now stop and think about it. First of all, can you tell me who the first three sons of Saul were? Well, if you come back to the 1st of Samuel, chapter 14, we're told. Here's the first three sons of Saul. They're all mentioned in the 1st of Samuel, chapter 14. And for that matter, the daughters. In the 1st of Samuel, chapter 14, let's just think about Saul's family for a moment. We're told this in verse 49. It says that the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Ishui and Malchishua. Now that Ishui there is also known as Abinadab in other places. So the three first sons of Saul were Jonathan, Abinadab or Ishui, and Malchishua. Can you remember those three names? Jonathan, Abinadab, Malchishua. Oh, and there are two daughters. The firstborn daughter is Merab, and the second daughter is Michal or Michal, the two daughters of Saul. Got all those names locked away in your head? Excellent. Now come to the 1st of Samuel chapter 31 and to the tragedy of Mount Gilboa, and let's see what happens there. So three sons of Saul and two daughters. But in the 1st of Samuel chapter 31, we're told in the battle of Mount Gilboa, the record says in verse 2 of that chapter, and the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons, and the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, Saul's sons. Ah, so all three sons mentioned in chapter 14 are now dead. But there was another son, wasn't there, of Saul, and his name was Ish-bosheth. Now if you come to the 2nd of Samuel, chapter 2, we've got him mentioned, and the circumstances of his death are rather dramatic as well. Because in the 2nd of Samuel chapter 2 and verse 8 it says, Abner the son of Ner, captain of Saul's host, took Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. So this is a fourth son of Saul. Jonathan, Abinadab, Malchishua are all dead, but there's a fourth son called Ish-bosheth who's going to be made king. Now when you come to the fourth chapter, this is what we're told about the death of Ish-bosheth. The record says in chapter 4 of 2 Samuel in verse 2, Saul's son had two men that were captains of bands. The name of the one was Baal and the name of the other was Rechab, sons of Rimmon, a Beerothite of the children of Benjamin. For Beeroth also was reckoned to Benjamin, and the Beerothites fled to Gittaim and were sojourners there unto this day. Just remember that for a minute. The Beerothites fled, and the two captains of Ish-bosheth's guard were both Beerothites. And verse 5 says, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, Rechab and Baana, went and came in the heat of the day to the house of Ish-bosheth, who lay on the bed at noon. They came through into the midst of the house, as though they would have fetched wine. They smote him under the fifth rib, and Rechab and Baana, his brother, escaped. And so now the fourth son of Saul is dead. So who slew him? Two men who were Beerothites. Ah. But Beeroth was one of the cities of the Gibeonites, mentioned in Joshua chapter 9. And I think that the reason why the Beerothites had fled, verse 3, was that Saul had come against the Gibeonites in Beeroth and had cruelly slain them. For this reason, that unto which tribe now does Beeroth belong? Verse 2. And the answer is, it was taken over by the tribe of Benjamin. But that's the tribe of Saul. And although I think Saul pretended that he had slain the Gibeonites because of his zeal for the truth, in reality what he did was he took the cities of the Gibeonites to enlarge the territory of the house of his own family in the land of Benjamin. And in the providence of God, Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, was slain by two men who were connected to the Beerothites and sympathetic to the tragedy that had come upon the Gibeonites in that place, you see. So now we've got all those four sons of Saul are now dead. So now let's think about the daughters. Now, in fact, if you come back to the 2nd of Samuel chapter 21, it's a little bit confusing really, isn't it? Because you see what it says? It says that that the king took the two sons of Rizpah, and the five sons And so these two sons of Rizpah, by the way, the daughter of Ai, whom she bare unto Saul, Armoni and Mephibosheth, do you know that they must be now the only two surviving, actual, literal sons of Saul? Every other son of Saul that we know of is already dead. But he had a concubine, you see, called Rizpah, who's the heroine of our story. And we haven't even got to her yet, by the way. It's a rather long introduction to get to Rizpah in this story. But she's coming, believe me, just by and by. And these are her two boys. And they are the sons, the actual sons of Saul, born to this concubine. But David needs more than two. He needs seven. So where does he get the other five from? Well, 2 Samuel 21 verse 8 says, he took the five sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillai. But the margin says that they weren't Michal's sons. They were Michal's sister's sons, which means they must be Merab's children, mustn't they? Because Merab's the only other daughter of Saul, Michal and Merab. And I believe that the margin is correct and absolutely right. For what reason? Because the 2 Samuel chapter 6 and verse 23 told us on an earlier occasion, after the matter of the bringing of the Ark of the Covenant into Zion, in the very last verse of the 2 Samuel chapter 6, the record says, therefore Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child unto the day of her death. So these five boys in the 2 Samuel chapter 21 can't be Michal's boys, can they? She had none. She was childless. No, these are Merab's sons. The other surviving daughter of Saul. And now come and have a look at Deuteronomy chapter 24. And let me just weave another riddle into the story for you, in case you thought it was all so simple so far. In Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse 16, what do you make of this then, in the context of these seven men that shall now be selected, the two sons of Rizpah and the five sons of Merab, the closest male descendants of Saul, really, that David can possibly choose? But Deuteronomy chapter 24 verse 16 said in the book of the law, the fathers shall not be put to death for the children, neither shall the children be put to death for the fathers. Every man shall be put to death for his own sin. So how was David able to take seven sons of the house of Saul, two real sons of Saul, and five grandsons, if they were absolutely innocent in the matter of Saul's murderous massacre of the Gibeonites? And the answer is, I think, that David didn't take innocent men at all. I think he chose the guilty ones. Now come and read the 2 Samuel 21 clearly. You know, it's all good Bible study. The marvellous thing about Bible study is that Bible thinking and Bible meditation is the joy and the privilege of sister and brother in the truth. We don't study to stand on the platform. We study to enthrall ourselves that we might live godly lives. Every brother, every sister is gifted with this capacity to read thoughtfully and well. Now read. You think these seven sons were innocent? I think not. Because of one crucial, tiny little word hidden in the story that tells me that these seven men probably took part in Saul's massacre against the Gibeonites. It's in verse 1, when Yahweh answered and said, this matter is not just for Saul alone, but for his house of blood. other members of his family had participated in the slaying of the Gibeonites. And again in verse 4, the Gibeonites said unto David, "We will have no silver nor gold, either of Saul nor of his house," says verse 4. And you see, I think in the providence of God, the seven men that David selected so carefully, so prayerfully, were all accomplices of Saul when he went forth on that raiding mission against the Gibeonites, not for the honour of God, but to enlarge the territory of his own family in the land of Benjamin. And God, who never forgets anything, brought all of this to account, you see, when these seven men were selected. And now finally, the record says, as a result of that in verse 9, that having selected these ones so carefully, he delivered them into the hands of the Gibeonites. They hanged them in the hill before Yahweh, and they fell, all seven together, and were put to death in the days of harvest, in the first days, in the beginning of barley harvest. Beginning of barley harvest. When the latter rains come. But now we have verse 10. The heroine of our story for tonight. I thank you so much for your patience in waiting for her to come. And I can promise you it's worthwhile, the wait. Because now enters Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, who quite possibly was innocent herself in this entire matter. She hadn't gone riding forth with Saul. She was just the concubine of the king. What had she to do in this particular matter? And the record says, verse 10, that Rizpah, this amazing, this astonishing woman, she, the daughter of Ai, took sackcloth and spread it for her upon the rock. Now, you'll probably know that sackcloth is associated with mourning for the dead. Genesis 37, verse 34 tells us that. 2 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 31 tells us that. Sackcloth is associated with mourning for the dead. But it's also connected with the public expression of repentance. With a public expression of repentance. It's used that way in the 1st of Kings chapter 21 and verse 27. And again in Nehemiah chapter 9 and verse 1. And as we read verse 10, we realise that the sackcloth wasn't there, was it, to protect the bodies. No, it was actually to spread upon the rock for herself. This was to be Ai's bed upon the rock. She lay upon sackcloth. And I think that the sackcloth here was to be an exhibition of public repentance that Ai would perform on the behalf of Israel as a whole on this occasion, for a reason that we shall come to very soon. Of course, in Israel we're told that it was a shame and a disgrace for bodies to be mutilated by being open to the beasts of the field and the birds of the air. Do you remember the 1st of Samuel, chapter 7, verse 17, verse 46, when David says to Goliath, the giant, "I will give your body to the beasts of the field and the birds of the air," and that was considered such a shameful thing that they would come and pick out the eyes and attack the body and the flesh. And to a Jew, to suffer death in that way was a shame, an ignominy. And Rizpah wanted to spare her sons from that shame as the bodies of these boys were hung up. Innocent of the guilt herself, she was simply a grieving mother caught up in a set of circumstances over which she had no personal control. And yet for all her grief and for all her anguish at the loss of her sons on this occasion, I think as the story unfolds, we suddenly realise that Ai must have had an amazing spirit of spiritual depth that we perhaps haven't hitherto appreciated. The record says that she took that sackcloth, she spread it for her upon the rock for her bed, and from the beginning of harvest until water dropped upon the mount of heaven, she suffered neither the birds of the air to rest upon them by day, nor the beasts of the field by night. Now, if these boys were hung up at the beginning of harvest in the month of Abib, when did the rains come of this verse? And the answer is, I believe they came in the month of Ethanim. 6 months later, at the end of harvest. So what we're being told is that Rizpah guarded these dead bodies, all seven of them, not just the bodies of her sons, all seven of these bodies, she guarded those bodies day and night for 6 months. She must have been exhausted. We don't know how she was fed or sustained. Perhaps some came out to nourish her. There's not a word that Rizpah ever speaks, just a silent vigil, absolutely desolated of spirit. And when you think about the agony of this woman, this mother in this record, guarding these dead bodies for so long, for 6 months, day and night, until she was just a gaunt, emaciated person herself, worn out by the privations of this vigil, in the spirit of Rizpah, don't you see, don't you hear, don't you feel flashes of the New Testament record? I can hear them. In the story of Rizpah, I can sense the love of Mary of Bethany that was compelled to anoint a body towards its impending death in Matthew 26 verse 13. In the spirit of Rizpah, I can feel the grief of Mary of Nazareth that compelled her to gaze upon the dead body of her son in John 19 verse 25. And in the grief of Rizpah, I can hear the honour of Mary of Magdala to bury the dead body after it was all over, that she might do honour to her Lord in John 20 verse 15. Mary of Bethany to anoint, Mary of Nazareth to gaze, Mary of Magdala to bury. Don't they all show the spirit of Rizpah towards the dead body of Christ in the New Testament record? I think so. I think there's a foreshadowing here, you see, hidden in the story of this sister. But I think, you see, the interesting thing about this story in the second of Samuel 21 is I don't think this was just a mother's act of devotion. Oh yes, it was that as well. Of course it was. But it must have been more than that. And I'll tell you why I think that's the case. Hold your hand in Samuel and come to Deuteronomy chapter 21. Because do you remember what the book of the law said concerning dead bodies? Strange thing. Because Deuteronomy chapter 21 specifically said this. Last two verses. Verses 22 and 23. And if a man have committed a sin worthy of death, well, just read this carefully, and he be put to death, and then thou shalt hang him on a tree. Did you notice that? Put to death first, then hung upon the tree. I think that's exactly what happened to these seven men in the second of Samuel 21. If a man has committed a sin worthy of death, and he be put to death, and thou shalt hang him upon a tree, his body shall not remain all night upon the tree, but thou shalt in any wise bury him that day. For he that is hanged is accursed of God, that thy land be not defiled, which Yahweh thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. Now you see, the book of the law expressly stated, did it not, that dead bodies were not to be left hanging for any more than one day, lest the land be defiled. And yet Rizpah has been watching over seven dead bodies that have been hanging up for 6 months. So why were they not taken down on the first night in accordance with the book of the law? Why are these bodies still on display 6 months later? And I think the answer is because of the very law that we saw earlier on concerning the law of murder in Numbers chapter 35. Just come back to it one more time and see how Numbers 35 finishes. And I think there was a very good reason, you see, why these bodies were still on display for this period of time. Because on this occasion, whilst the law said that a body that was left to hang defiled the land, was it not true that on this occasion, verse 33 of Numbers 35, the land had already been defiled by the shedding of the innocent blood of the Gibeonites? And this sacrifice, well, see what it says, verse 33, "So shall ye not pollute the land wherein ye are, for blood that defileth the land, and the land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed therein, but by the blood of him that shed it. Defile not therefore the land which ye shall inhabit, wherein I dwell, for I, Yahweh, dwell among the children of Israel." And the lesson, you see, of the seven men, the bodies of whom lie open and exposed for the 6 months of the 2nd of Samuel 21, is that this sacrifice was to be an atonement which continued to be presented before God until the signal of national forgiveness came from sin by the lifting of the famine. Only then could it be sure that God had accepted this expiatory sacrifice, and that's what it was. Because hadn't David said, back in the 2nd of Samuel chapter 21 and verse 3, hadn't he said that this whole matter was so that he might make atonement? That's what these seven bodies were all about, weren't they? And these atoning sacrifices were going to remain exposed before Yahweh until the cessation of the famine showed that his forgiveness had been extended. And until God sent that sign, these bodies lay lifted up before him. And so the record says, 2 Samuel chapter 21 and verse 10, that Rizpah guarded these bodies day and night for month after month after month. And the record says, until the water dropped upon them and drenched the bodies with rain. And then, strange to it to seem, she immediately stops guarding them. When they all got wet, she suddenly walks away and leaves the bodies as soon as they're wet with rain. Why did she do that? Had her devotion suddenly ceased? Had her commitment to her son suddenly stopped? No, she didn't just do this as an act of devotion, did she? There was something deeper and more profound in Rizpah's spirit. You see, I think what she'd really done was this. She knew, despite her grief, that the death of her sons on this occasion were part of an atoning sacrifice for national sin, which she herself stood in need of. And she guarded the bodies not just of her sons, but of the sacrificial victims, so that they would not be desecrated until Yahweh accepted the sacrifice. And doesn't that remind you of Genesis chapter 15, when Abraham lays out the parts of the sacrifice and chases the birds away until the sacrifice should be accepted? Genesis 15. See, Rizpah knew that there was something deeper going on here. In all her grief, she knew, I believe, that the whole nation depended on this offering, and that her sons were part of the way by which salvation would come. And what was her proof? What finally convinced her that God had forgiven the nation, and that atonement had been wrought? Well, the record says simply that she waited till the water dropped. How did she know that the water was the sign? Because why had the famine come in verse 1? Because the water had stopped. And how did she know that Yahweh had accepted the sacrifice? Because now rain again poured out of heaven, which is what the word means, by the way, when it says the water dropped upon them. The water absolutely cascaded upon them. And when that water poured out, the water of the former rains, 6 months later, when the rain fell, Rizpah knew that Yahweh had accepted the sacrifice and blessed the nation with forgiveness. Oh, what a woman was this, who could see beyond her own grief and tragedy to the needs of a whole nation. Does that remind you of another woman who had to endure a similar piercing of her soul for atoning sacrifice, for national good? And verse 11 says, "And it was told David, what Rizpah the daughter of Ai, the concubine of Saul, had done. And I think when David understood what Rizpah had done, his mind leapt to the significance of what she'd done. He understood, David knew what she'd done and why. His spirit marvelled with the spirit of Rizpah, this amazing sister on this occasion. So you see what he did? You see what David did in response, you see? Oh yes, he understood what Rizpah had done. Because verse 12 says this. It says that David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son. And by the way, not just the bones of Jonathan, but the bones of Abinadab and the bones of Malchishua, all three sons, from the men of Jabesh-Gilead, which had stolen them from the sheep of Beth-Shan, where the Philistines had hanged them, when the Philistines had slain Saul in Gilboa. Now, do you remember what I said earlier on? You've got to read carefully. So I just read that verse again and just change one word. So you see the force of what David's about to do. Verse 11, it was told David what Rizpah the daughter of Ai, the concubine of Saul, had done. And David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son from the men of Jabesh-Gilead, which had stolen them from the street of Beth-Shan, where the Philistines had hanged them. Ah. So you see, Saul and three sons had all been hung on the walls of Beth-Shan. And now seven other men of the house of Saul have been hung in Gibeah in chapter 21. And what David is going to do in effect is he's going to bind Saul and all his house into the matter of this sin and its atonement. Saul and three sons who already have been hung together on a prior occasion. He now collects those bodies and brings them together with the bodies of these ones who now have been hung in Gibeah. And that's what verse 13 says. It says, he brought up from thence the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son, and they gathered the bones of them that were hanged. Now you see that word hanged in verse 13, that's not the same as the word hanged in verse 12. So I think that those that are hanged in verse 13 are the bones that have just been hanged in this chapter. He gathers all the bones of all the house of Saul together. They've all been hung, but at different times. And verse 14 says that the bones of Saul and of Jonathan his son, and for that matter the bones of all the other members of the family, buried they in the country of Benjamin, in Zelah, in the sepulchre of Kish his father, and they performed all that the king commanded. And so the burial of the whole clan now in the family sepulchre, as it were, closed the account of the sacrifice for sin. And I think that David responded to Rizpah's devotion by allowing her sons and all the other members of the family of Saul's household that had thus been slain, he gave them all now the dignity of a proper, full family burial, didn't he? He said, well, now that this is all over, let's at least inter the whole family with dignity and with honour. That was a noble thing of Saul, of David to do, wasn't it? But I think he did it for another reason, you see. Oh yes, I think there was another reason. Now look at this. Oh, I think this is wonderful. Hold your hand in the 2nd of Samuel and just come back to the 1st of Samuel chapter 24. We're almost there. We're almost at the end of the story, but let's just tiptoe through the last few ideas. Why did David take all these bones of all these bodies, seven men, three men, one man, and bury them all together in the country of Benjamin and Zelah in the sepulchre of Kish, Saul's father? Well, because in the 1st of Samuel, chapter 24, we're told this, in verse 20, that when David was chasing, or rather when David was fleeing from Saul and Saul was chasing him, Saul said this, and now, behold, I know well that thou shalt surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in thine hand. Swear now therefore unto me by Yahweh, said Saul, that thou wilt not cut off my seed after me, and that thou wilt not
destroy my name out of my father's house. And David swear unto Saul. And so what does he do in the 2nd of Samuel chapter 21? He honours the oath that he's made. Because although Saul is dead, and his three sons, and these seven other boys of the family, he gathers them all together, he gathers the bones of all the family. Where does he bury them? Where exactly does he bury them? 2nd of Samuel 21, verse 14. He buries them in the sepulchre of Kish, the father of Saul, so that Saul's name might not be destroyed from his father's house. And David honored the oath which he'd made to Saul. See, there was never any malice in David. I think he grieved as much as any other at the desolation of Saul's house on this occasion, but he was a good man. He was an honourable man. He always acted with the best objectives in mind. And so just think about what David does in this chapter. In concert with Rizpah, two of the most astounding personalities in this story, and for that matter the Gibeonites as well, all of whom acted honourably, really, don't you think? The Gibeonites asked in accordance with the law. David acts in accordance with his own oaths. In fact, what David does is this. Think about it in this chapter. Think about how carefully David walked through this terribly, terribly difficult chapter. He satisfied the request of the Gibeonites. He honoured the vigil of Rizpah by giving his boys, her boys, a decent burial. He respected his vow to Saul. He offered a final salute to Jonathan. And he upheld all of Yahweh's principles out of the law. And he did all of that, all at one and the same time, as this story unfolds. David did all of that. But Rizpah was his inspiration. And we know that that must have been such a good thing to do, because do you see how the story finishes? At the end of verse 14. And after that, God was entreated for the land. Not just from the vigil of Rizpah, but by the prayers of David and by the falling of the water and by the final lifting of the famine, all of this terrible time was brought to an end and people's lives moved on. And you know, I suppose that Rizpah wouldn't be the first woman who has found herself in the midst of circumstances over which she has no control. A time when she's powerless to do anything about other things that come upon her and upon her family. But perhaps the greatest lesson of Rizpah is her ability, even in the midst of grief, to try as best as she could to perceive the overarching purpose of God in all things. And I think she found it, even in the death of her boys, you see. She understood a greater thing than her own family and her own grief, her own anguish. She dimly perceived the purpose of God at work and bowed before that purpose and sought to guard those sacrificial victims until Yahweh himself answered from heaven. And now you think about the parts of the story, you see. Seven men of the same house as those that have sinned, meaning that a representative offering of the same flesh as that which had sinned must be offered for a complete atoning sacrifice. So whom did these seven sons really foreshadow? Oh, and where was the place of death? Why, the royal city of the covenant breakers. In the hill of God, it says, before Yahweh. What all those things remind us of. And when was the time of death? Why, at the time of barley harvest. And John 6 tells us that the time of Passover, when our Lord was offered in sacrifice, was at the time of barley harvest, says John 6 verse 4 and verse 9. Our Lord was offered at the very same time as these seven men fell, all of them together, as the record says. And we suddenly realise that Rizpah in this story represents the women community of the saints who maintain a vigil over the sacrificial body of Christ, who guard its meaning, who honour its symbol, who protect the work of Christ from desecration by their own vows of dedication until the purpose of God shall finally be fulfilled. And in Rizpah we see all the community of the saints who learn to honour the sacrifice of our Lord Jesus Christ. In this woman we're all to be found, in the story of the truth, you see. I don't think Rizpah understood that, do you, on this day? Do you think that she understood that she would prefigure the bride of Christ, weeping and remembering with grief the slaying of the complete sacrifice for sins? She never would have understood that, and yet in the providence of God he outworked a parable in the life of this woman. And maybe that's the greatest lesson of all. You see, as we go through our own valleys of despair, we would never dream for a moment, would we, that God was working parables in our lives. But he can, and he does, and he shall, and he will. If we commit ourselves to always doing what's best for the truth and to honouring God, even when we don't understand him and we can't see the way clear and we don't know in fullness the purpose of the Father, but if in the midst of all our grief we say that whatever will be best for the truth we shall try and do, God can work parables in our lives that one day we might remember and look back with astonishment to see that in some small way our own lives were a foreshadowing of spiritual things. So let's be thankful for the story of Rizpah, who on this dreadful occasion in her own life rose above the circumstances of her own life and triumphed to do that which saved the nation and won the approval of the king. And finally, the blessing of peace upon her own family and her own boys in the process. Here ends the story. And I'm so sorry, sisters, that I've run on just a tad longer than I expected. But I hope as a result of that, that maybe a chapter that was a little bit of an enigma and a conundrum besides, wrapped up in the riddle, might at least in some part now have been unravelled, so that we can be thankful for the story of this woman who appears just for this one moment and disappears again, and yet just that one moment's enough, isn't it, for us to be touched and moved and affected for good if we learn the story of her life. So are there any questions before we close? Yes.
I'm sure about the fear of heights. And I missed that.
Okay. In the book of Joshua chapter 9, we're told that there were four cities of the Gibeonites. Gibeon, Kephira, Beeroth, and Kirjath-Jearim. So that's where the Gibeonites lived. And the strange thing is that the two captains that slew Ishbosheth the son of Saul, we're told that they were both Beerothites. Now it does say that they were children of Benjamin, but they could have even been Gibeonites themselves, for all we know. But if they weren't Gibeonites, they were certainly men that were sympathetic to the Gibeonites, because they live in a city of the Gibeonites, in Beeroth. And the record tells us, expressly in the 2 Samuel chapter 4, that the Beerothites had all fled. And I think the reason why they fled is because Saul had come upon them to massacre them and to take over their city. And that therefore these two captains slew Ishbosheth in retribution for what he'd done against the Gibeonites, you see. And that there was a strange circling of the story as to the identity of these two men that came upon Ishbosheth in the heat of day and slew Ishbosheth upon his bed. They came from one of the very cities of the Beerothites who'd been so cruelly slain by Saul in this massacre. That make sense? Right. I don't know why I chose such a gloomy topic, apart from the fact that I love this story and I'm moved by the spirit of this woman. And I think she was an astonishing person that she was able to do this. And she inspired the king to finish the story off, and I love that thought. And in the middle of all this, don't you think it's so eloquent that we never ever hear a word out of the mouth of Rizpah? Just what she's done. But what she did was so wonderful and so powerful that the king of the realm was moved to salute Rizpah herself by what he does to finish the story off, and in such an honourable way. And I love that story for that reason, and for its foreshadowings of the work of Christ yet to come in the New Testament record.